Another sign that America is the home of the brave. More Americans are buying raw milk. Milk that's not been pasteurized to kill bacteria, neither the good nor the bad kind. The FDA does not support this practice, so there are no national safety guidelines. And some people are trying to change that. Dina Pritchett reports.
Shampooey Creamery is a small dairy about 30 miles south of Portland, Oregon, complete with fields, chickens, and a few brown cows. Charlotte Smith is a fifth-generation farmer. But when she first started producing raw milk, she found the usual ag resources weren't around.
I could call at the extension office and get some help on what was going on with my vegetables or what is this beetle eating my tomatoes, but there's no one that will help you with raw milk production.
And with about 100 families buying her milk, Smith wants to get it right.
So you could bring home a chicken and sell the egg and feel pretty safe about it. But raw milk coming out of a cow and manure flying during milking time, it is a huge challenge, far different than any other farm animal we have.
And so, 2 years ago, Shampooey Creamery became the first farm listed with the Raw Milk Institute.
People are searching for local raw milk, but when they go to the farm or they go to the store, they really don't know what they're getting.
Dairy farmer Mark McAfee founded the institute. Instead of just focusing on the end results, like bacteria levels, they also work up detailed protocols for the entire process, from taking the temperature of the dishwasher to looking at the risks specific to each farm.
The conditions, the elevation, the water, the breed of cow you have.
Approved dairies list their guidelines and bacteria counts for anyone to see. But McAfee knows that certification has its discontents.
They're going to say there's no way to guarantee the safety of raw milk because it doesn't go through pasteurization. So the bottom line is, cantaloupe just killed 34 people in the last 2.5 years. So what is relative risk here?
If there were an easy way to pasteurize cantaloupe, I think, you know, that would be something to consider.
Robert Toks is an epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention who deals with foodborne illness. The raw milk outbreaks he sees...
Salmonella infections, E. coli infections, Campylobacter infections...
...are generally not fatal, but they can land you in the hospital.
I understand the interest in having colonies of living bacteria in the food we eat. The problem is when those living bacteria that are beneficial get mixed up with the living bacteria that cause disease.
While raw milk protocols can reduce the chance of these bad bacteria, or catch them early, Toke says it's no guarantee.
A cow can test negative today and then get infected tomorrow.
It's scary, I mean, but I also eat oysters.
Adrian Hale lives in Portland, and as a mother and food writer, she's always looking for the full story of whatever she eats.
There's a lot of choices we make with food, so I try to make those choices as best I can.
For Hale, making a good choice means buying raw milk that meets these guidelines. Especially with two young kids drinking it.
I don't want to be a negligent parent. I just wanted that assurance that the person who's producing the milk is paying attention.
And if the producer and the consumer are paying attention, it can create a risk that's more manageable, whether you're talking about oysters or cantaloupe or raw milk. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett in Portland, Oregon.
On this 4th of July morning, many of you across this country might be waking up to thoughts of firing up that grill. Many kids, well, you might be thinking about ice cream. It is a treat that, like few others, has the power to evoke nostalgia. Just listen to this moment from a promotional film distributed back in 1955 by the National Dairy Council. It depicts a grandfather looking back on summers when he was a boy.
Yes, every Sunday in those days before television, radio, and movies, making ice cream was usually a family event. And it was sure worth all the bother. If we wanted ice cream, I turned the crank.
And handmade ice cream is still pretty special. For this Independence Day, my colleague Renee Montaigne paid a visit to the Cool House ice cream shop just a few blocks from NPR West in Culver City, California. Their creative new flavors are being used as building blocks in crafting the ultimate ice cream sandwich.
Ice cream. Ice cream. Something to know about Natasha Cates, the co-founder of Cool House, is that she was not trained as a cook. She was trained as an architect, where one of her graduate school projects set her on the path to designing ice cream instead of buildings.
At UCLA, where I went for grad school, I just got into different ways of using food as the medium to talk about architecture. How could food send people a message or educate people about design? So I called it Farkitecture, food plus architecture.
She even made an architectural model out of a layer cake. It's a concept that greets you the moment you step into the door of this ice cream shop. There on the wall, a life-size image of the man who inspired the name Cool House, architect Rem Cool House.
I consider myself very punny, a punisher, if you will. And Cool House is a play on Bauhaus architecture, and Rem Cool House, the architect. And then the third kind of entendre there is the ice cream sort of look like little cold houses, as do our trucks.
Little cool houses,
yes. But it's punny and it's silly because the idea was making architecture fun and accessible and digestible for people.
Some of these silly puns are found in the names of Cool House's ice cream sandwiches. I Am Pay becomes I Am Peanut Butter. Mies Van Der Rohe becomes Mies Vanilla Der Rohe. Now, Cool House is out with a book of ice cream recipes, and our lesson in building ice cream sandwiches began with the cookies, which function as the foundation.
There's definitely an architecture to the sandwich. The foundation, it has to be pliable. It has to be a little chewy so that it can hold the scoop and as you're eating the sandwich not fall apart and not just crunch off. The ice cream itself is kind of the glue of the sandwich. It holds it all together. And then the top cookie as well. If it's too hard and too crunchy, it's just going to push all the center of the ice cream sandwich out.
Making ice cream has gotten a lot easier from the days of rock salt and endless churning. Today's electric ice cream makers hum quietly as they churn on their own.
So this is the custard base that I've made actually last night. We do recommend chilling it overnight for best consistency or at least 5 hours. It's just organic milk, cream, sugar, and egg yolks. It's 8 egg yolks.
And Natasha Kay says the absolute key to great ice cream is getting the base right.
The base is the part that most people, when they make ice cream, mess up, actually.
What's to mess up?
So when you're making the base, very, very commonly, people just either throw the eggs in or there's too much hot milk, cream, and sugar on the eggs too fast, and then they'll just sort of curdle. And then you don't want to cook the custard too long either because it will become a harder, more solid custard. But once you've made the base right, I mean, literally you're putting it in the machine and then adding your inclusions. So usually from there, you're good to go.
Inclusions. That's the ice cream industry's term for the chunks and chips and bits that are folded into the ice cream. In this case, we're going to make Cool House's dirty mint chip. Usually, mint chip is flavored by mint extract or an oil. Natasha Case uses only fresh mint leaves, chopped up surprisingly rough.
And then you leave the mint in there. And what it does is it continues to infuse the ice cream over time, so it actually gets more powerful.
Then she hands me a third of a cup of the chopped mint.
Do you want to put the mint in?
Sure. And the next inclusion, chocolate chips.
So I'm putting that a half cup.
So, mint chocolate chip, a classic and delicious. Still, many of Cool House's customers are part of a taste trend. They come in the door looking for an adventure in ice cream.
The palate has evolved. More and more are not sweet on sweet on sweet flavors are bigger ones. People like a lot of savory. They like a lot of spice. They like sour. So we have, for example, our fried chicken and waffles ice cream, which is total salt and savory, and that's one of our best sellers. We just launched a goat milk caramel with mascarpone and rosemary. The mascarpone is a little savory. The goat milk caramel is actually quite sour. Again, huge hit. A few years ago, we had our sweet corn and blueberry ice cream as a summer flavor. It wasn't that big, to be honest. We brought it back this season. It's huge.
All these loopy flavors have serious implications for the two cookies holding together the ice cream sandwich that we are here to taste this summer day.
Chewy, not overly sweet, because if you're going to have two and ice cream, you don't want to be in a food coma after. In fact, in many of the recipes, it's just brown sugar, and brown sugar is only half as sweet as white sugar, but it also creates that caramelly, chewy component, so that's really key. Ice cream.
Now at last, between two oatmeal raisin cookies, brown sugar only, Natasha Case gently places a big scoop of balsamic fig mascarpone ice cream.
This is the fun part is actually strategizing around the fact that you've got to like keep it together.
Yeah, I would say so.
In fact, it makes me want to run out into the hot sun just to make it that much harder. But thank you. This was delicious.
Awesome. It was my pleasure to have you here.
You can make your own balsamic fig mascarpone ice cream and the dirty mint chip. We've got recipes from the Cool House Ice Cream book on our website, npr.org. And on this 4th of July, you're listening to Morning Edition on NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green.
Ice cream, everybody want ice cream, rock, rock my baby rock.
And now I'm feeling hungry. Maybe for a breakfast burrito? It would have to be a really good one, though. I can't settle for a subpar tortilla stuffed with dried out beans and rice. If only there were a burrito correspondent who could give me some tips. Well, NPR doesn't have anyone staffing that important beat, so we'll have to borrow Anna Maria Barry Jester. She's traveling the country for the website 538, eating her way through a definitive burrito bracket. Anna Maria Barry Jester joins us now from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How many burritos have you eaten to date for this project?
Well, 64 in the bracket, but there have been some extracurricular burritos as well, so probably closer to 80.
Are you sick of burritos yet?
You would think, but it's this weird sort of, the more I get to know them, more they become different objects with such different ingredients that I love them more with each passing day.
So I have a burrito specimen here with me in the studio. I'm going to unwrap.
Is it in wax paper or tin foil?
It is in both tin foil and wax paper.
Ooh, that's a good technique. You know, in San Francisco, they're really into the tin foil wrap, but a lot of people don't like that because it keeps the moisture in. Mm. It can get a little bit gooey or moist in unpleasant ways. So some people use wax paper, but then, you know, the opposite can happen. It can dry out if you don't use tin foil.
Okay, so I understand that you have a scoring system. So walk me through this burrito. Let's dissect this thing.
Okay, so I rate it on five criteria. The first category is the tortilla.
Okay.
I mean, obviously something that's been freshly made, usually in-house, is kind of the golden standard. The second category is the main protein. And so it's the quality of the meat and the flavor and the texture. And then the third category is the other ingredients.
So that's like salsa or guacamole?
Exactly. And okay. Rice and beans. If it's Korean, maybe it's kimchi. And then the fourth category is the overall flavor profile. Usually you want something with some sweet, some heat, salt, you know, how it all combines together as one object. And then there's the presentation. So that's partly how it's rolled and then also how all the textures come together.
You are a photographer, so you've been taking pictures of each of your burrito contenders, but you've been taking a controversial approach to photographing the burrito. Can you describe that?
It's not the most attractive view of a burrito, and I've definitely gotten some feedback that people are horrified that I would do this to a burrito. But I'm taking the burrito and sort of filleting it, cutting it in half down the middle, and then opening it up so you can see if there is there a lot of rice, the colors, that kind of thing. So I think it adds another layer of information.
Anna Maria Barry Jester, burrito correspondent for the 538 blog. Happy eating and buena suerte.
Muchas gracias.
For centuries, Jews in Morocco distilled a clear liquor made from figs or dates. It was called mahia. The practice of making mahia had all but disappeared, and then a Moroccan Jew living in New York decided to revive his family's distilling practice. Alex Schmidt has this story about one couple's efforts to make a viable new business out of an ancient tradition.
Is it the fourth one? I'm not sure. Did you taste it?
It's the middle of the workday, and David and Dorit Namias are busy in their tiny distillery. In the entryway are Moroccan rugs, photos of David's parents, and an old-fashioned copper still. This is a sort of contraption David's family used to distill in Morocco.
I grew up you know, people constantly coming to our home and asking for mahya, and everyone, the Jews and Muslim, everyone, including the cops. So mahya, it was part of the tradition, living with people, you know, Jews and Muslim live together.
David had wanted to start a professional mahya distillery for as long as he'd known his wife, but they both had stable jobs in the banking industry, and she wouldn't hear of it.
Why would you give all that up to start a business? It was like, it was stupid. It was ridiculous.
But then a few years ago, David's parents passed away at the same time Dorit lost her job.
When you don't have that security anymore, you have to take a chance.
Now the equipment is more professional than home brewing back in Morocco. Shiny, cylindrical, industrial-sized stills. But most people have no idea what mahya is. The Namiases are trying every marketing trick they can to gain a foothold. A major one? Alcohol-tasting events like Manhattan's Whiskey Jubilee. Attendees paid over $100 a pop to come here and sample fine whiskey and other liquors. The Namiases also distill whiskey, which gives them an entry point into markets that might otherwise be closed to them. The crowd stream in, and David starts pitching.
We make this 100% from figs. There is no sugar, no chemicals, nothing, and it's very natural.
Dean Schuckman takes a sip of the clear liquor.
This is excellent. It's smooth. I can taste a little bit of the fig. It's delicious.
Score 1 point for mahya. But then Dana Siegel takes a sip, and she just doesn't get it.
I thought it was interesting. I kind of wanted to understand a little bit more what type of spirit it is. If it's a flavored vodka, that's one thing. If it's a liqueur, it's another. I couldn't quite figure it out. But the fig flavor came through, and I really liked that a lot.
Technically, mahya is an eau de vie, which just means it's a clear fruit brandy. Schnapps is eau de vie, and so is aquavit. Mahya joins a band of unfamiliar alcohols trying to gain a market in the U.S. There's cachaça from Brazil, pisco from Chile. Derek Brown writes about alcohol and owns several bars. He says sometimes unknown spirits do become popular.
Might be hard to imagine at this point, but vodka was once a weirdo spirit in the United States. There was an advertising campaign around it. They're very famous one in the 1960s, and they had very famous people like Woody Allen, you know, toasting the Smirnoff. And today it is the most widely sold spirit in the United States.
The Namiases have gotten some cutting-edge mixologists to incorporate mahya into cocktails on their menus. Step by step, they hope they'll build this ancient family tradition into a business they can pass on to their kids. For NPR News, I'm Alex Schmidt in New York.